WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, which will launch an RN to BSN program in January. Practicing nurses with an associate degree can complete a Bachelor of Science in Nursing in 16 months, taking a mix of online and on-campus courses. More information available at carthage.edu/BSN. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On this momentously important election day, we're actually going to have a bit of fun on today's morning show with two interviews from the archives. The first, from way back in 2002, is with Judith Martin, otherwise known as Miss Manners, talking about her fascinating book, Star Spangled Manners, in which Miss Manners defends American etiquette for a change. It seems appropriate as we come to the end of this bruising, hard-fought, and sometimes ill-mannered season of political campaigning. In part two, in an interview recorded back in 2003, you'll hear from Ace Collins, author of Songs Sung Red, White, and Blue, the stories behind America's best-loved patriotic songs. Here's part one.
Well, words scarcely convey how excited I am to be speaking today on the morning show with Judith Martin, Miss Manners. If I would go to my very crowded bookshelf and pull off every book I own by Judith Martin, Miss Manners, it would make quite a pile. I own every single book, and I'm delighted to have the newest one in my hands right now called Star Spangled Manners, in which Miss Manners defends American etiquette for a change. The book is published by W.W. Norton & Company, and we're delighted that Judith Martin can join us for a few minutes to talk about what America has contributed to the world when it comes to etiquette. Judith Martin, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you.
What preface the writing of this book? How did the idea come to you to focus on this particular facet of etiquette?
Well, you know, I've been leading the attack on American manners for something like 25 years. And when I started, people didn't know what I was talking about. You know, etiquette, that's a thing of the past. We don't have any manners. And I thought, well, you know, you're right there. That's the problem. But eventually, it took a while, it caught on, and I started hearing everywhere how rude Americans are. Now, this is something one hears abroad all the time, and I resent it when I'm abroad, and I began to worry about it here. I won't say resent it, but worry, do Americans have an inferiority complex that somehow we are just sort of naturally loutish, and if we knew how to behave, we would be Europeans, so that we're just sort of some sort of little failure at behaving like those perfect people who live abroad. And I've lived abroad enough myself to know that they've got human beings there, too, including rude ones. So when you look at American manners, I realized, first of all, it's the major influence on manners in the world today. And second of all, that it is the noblest attempt to treat other people with dignity. We have made a concerted effort in this country, the founding fathers were deep into this, to develop the etiquette of egalitarianism. We haven't fully succeeded, and we certainly haven't fully succeeded in practicing it. But it's a very noble attempt, and it keeps going on. And it's not something that should be dismissed as an inept imitation of European manners.
Hmm. You call it at one point the basic American commitment to the etiquette of equality. Given that, you do mention the fact that the way etiquette unfolds and develops and ebbs and flows is what you call at one point a regular ricocheting from predictability to creativity and back from chaos to constriction. There is sort of a tide to the way etiquette sort of grows, and America has certainly not been immune to that.
No, we are coming, this is why it's such an interesting period right now, we are coming out of the idea in the second half of the 20th century that there was something wrong about etiquette itself. It's artificial, which of course it is. It's a civilizing influence over nature. And that we should not practice it. We should not teach it to our children. And that went on for decades to the point where we developed a couple of generations of people who had been taught just to express themselves and not worry about what other people think of them. And life became so abrasive that we reached that turning point. Now, typically, the repeated cycles are that's what happens, because this is not the first time that people have come up with the idea that natural behavior is better than civilized behavior. I think Mr. Rousseau came up with that some time ago, and others have. But the reaction is usually to develop manners, but then people go overboard with that, and the manners get so complicated and so stilted that there's a reaction against them. So I keep trying to stop this pendulum and say, let us go there in the middle where we have manners that are useful and workable and so on, but not oppressive.
I appreciate so much the way you talk about the principle behind etiquette and the important function which it serves. One of the things you mention is that if a nation did not have etiquette at all, then most likely it would seek out what you call the heavy hand of the law to govern trivial transgressions. That's not the arena of the law. That belongs in the purview of etiquette.
Exactly so. And people who want to get rid of etiquette do so in the name of freedom. And when they bring the law in, they have less freedom. Because if you're rude, I can refuse to associate with you, but I can't put you in jail, which would certainly compromise your freedom a lot more. We've had an interesting demonstration of this phenomena in the world of cyberspace, which, as you recall, originally people said this is going to be absolutely free and open, no rules. And then people started with intolerable behavior. Pornography to those who did not want to receive it. Spam, which is a major problem for all of us. And they are trying to get the law to regulate it. But it is very difficult for the law to regulate cyberspace.
One of the things you say about etiquette is that it defines a community by providing the language of rituals and symbols with which members identify their commonality while busily sizing up one another individually. That was a concept I hadn't really thought of before, the idea that that etiquette can provide both a sense of commonality and individuality. I mean, that right in and of itself is sort of a miracle, isn't it?
Yes. When you have a general standard, the deviations that people wish to make from it for any kind of individualistic reasons stand out. When you have total chaos with no general standard, you don't know what anything means. But we all read clothing symbolically. People deny it, and they say that, they're just wearing what's comfortable or to express themselves, but we read it symbolically. And if I showed up in cut-off jeans at your wedding, you would read that as being disrespectful, and you would be correct. Or if I showed up in an evening gown on your picnic, you would read it as being probably insanity on my part, and you'd be correct. At the same time we're denying all this symbolism, we're practicing it.
We are speaking with Judith Martin, author of a wonderful new book called Star Spangled Manners, in which Miss Manners defends American etiquette for a change. One of the things you say about American etiquette is the fact that it is founded on egalitarianism. But one of the things you say then is the etiquette of egalitarianism is always in flux because it responds to the will of the people. I suppose that's one of the things that makes it then by its very nature not quite so fixed in stone as maybe other systems of etiquette might be.
It's not at all fixed in stone, because when we started with all men are created equal, first of all, it was men and not women, and it wasn't all men, it wasn't slaves, it wasn't often it wasn't people who didn't own property were not equal for in legal terms. So we have been working on this and expanding it and improving on it since the birth of the country, and I hope we'll continue to do so.
As these young Americans were forging this system of etiquette for a new nation, in what most significant ways were they discarding other systems and ideals in favor of this new idea of etiquette for all?
Well, they wanted to do away with ostentation because they felt that ostentation reinforced the economic differences. They certainly did away with the class system. We did away with titles and any hereditary signs of inequality. Those were the obvious things, and those were the things that were put into effect immediately. But then the question arose of, okay, if everybody's equal, what about the inequalities of achievement, of age, of rank? And so then it gets a little more dicey to deal with. But the Founding Fathers did an amazing job of overthrowing concepts that people thought were natural, that some people are inferior and other people are superior. They didn't do it completely, as we well know. But it was revolutionary itself to say that we're born equal, or that enough of the people they defined as being equal were born equal.
You tell us about the important insights brought to all this by three of our founding fathers in particular, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and Benjamin Franklin. You mentioned the fact that each of these three gentlemen was very interested in etiquette before they became members of the revolutionary movement in this young new country, and they brought each of them their own perspective on what was most important in assembling a new system of etiquette.
Yes, Thomas Jefferson's book on a parliamentary etiquette is still given out to congressmen. He almost invented the paperback. He wanted it printed small so they could put it in their pockets, and as far as we can tell now, they put it in their pockets and they never take it out. But they realized they had the task of developing a new etiquette, which is a extraordinary idea. People grow up thinking, well, this whatever they grew up with is natural behavior, and the idea that you can monkey around with it and develop something better is a strange, strange idea to which we are very grateful they all subscribed. They did, Washington and Jefferson in particular, went off in a little bit too much in opposite directions. George Washington was thought to be a little on the arrogant side. Thomas Jefferson was thought to be a little on the overly, artificially humble side. And Franklin struck this wonderful happy medium, where it charmed the world, not just America, but you know, it was extremely popular in Paris when he was our minister there. But all of them were dealing with, how do you have dignity without ostentation? How do you have equality and yet have respect? And these are questions we still need to work on.
Hmm. Of course, it may not be exactly a central question in terms of its pertinence to us today, but it is fascinating to read in your book about how the founding fathers grappled with the question of how one was to address the President of the United States. What is most significant to us in 2003 about those discussions and arguments which occurred back in the 18th century?
Well, to this day, we have a major effect on world diplomacy, stripping it of its more elaborate rituals and such. George Washington thought it would be really kind of cute to be addressed as His High and Mightiness, and he was laughed out of that because we wanted to get to that Republican simplicity, which in fact is taking over the world. That particular issue, why is it relevant to us today? Well, we call our president Mr. President. We don't use highness, royalty, mightiness, all of those things. And yet we use the term Mr. Now, and I hope someday, Madam, the honorifics like that have been dropped in everyday life. People refer to one another either by first name or even more or less formally by last names unadorned with honorifics. When you get a letter today, it probably just has your name on it and no honorific. If you think about it, the solution of Mr. President has this double thing. It's simple, and yet there is that respectful term in there. Why are we doing away with the simple terms of respect in everyday life?
Hmm. You mentioned in the discussion about the whole concept of equality and how it relates to etiquette that, in fact, we are not all equal in every way. And this, I don't mean by our human intrinsic worth, but just in terms of our uniqueness, each as individuals. We are not all the same. We are not identically equal in that way. And you posed the question, should we ignore that fact and act as we were? You go on to say, politeness cannot survive without ignoring facts. And you say that that's something we're not very good at anymore, ignoring those differences between us, which sometimes impress us and sometimes irritate us.
Well, to some extent, you do need to recognize them. There is a dignity and respect to which we are all entitled as human beings because we are human beings. At the same time, and we've done away with many of the precedence systems that used to exist. But at the same time, age makes a difference. Giving precedence to age is the fairest possible distribution of this that there is, because with any luck, we all live to grow older. We want to give recognition to achievement. There is a special respect for people who have made contributions to the world, and that is a legitimate thing. We give recognition to rank. In the business world, right now we have a pretense that everybody who works together are just friends and they all treat one another alike, and yet there are people there who can fire other people or give other people raises. They're not equal. Those inequalities should be recognized, but they should not touch upon the basic dignity that we have as human beings.
Hmm.
And in a world that is so business-oriented and people feel that everything has to do, for instance, with their jobs, and they have no dignity if their job is not does not command it, they're wrong. They have the dignity of being a human being. So you're a person who does not, you don't have to disguise the fact that you are where you are on the job rank, because that's only part of your life.
Hmm. One last question. You point out something which I think is so thought-provoking in saying that, first of all, we should not jump to the conclusion that our founding fathers and the citizens of our young nation were exceptionally well-behaved, and you say that when we look at the new egalitarian etiquette which they created for this new country, that tells us something about probably the way in which many people drove each other crazy. We can look at etiquette, at the way we want people to live, and it tells us something about the way, in fact, they probably lived.
You know, that's how I got into an interest in etiquette in the first place, that my parents, who were amateur historians, explained to me, if you want to know about a society, whatever they're being told not to do, that's what they're doing.
Judith Martin's book is Star Spangled Manners, in which Miss Manners defends American etiquette for a change, published by W.W. Norton & Company. Again, this interview was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2002. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD. In the background, you hear Morton Gould's American Salute. That is helping us introduce part two of today's Morning Show. From the archives, a 2003 interview with author Ace Collins about his book, Songs Sung Red, White, and Blue, the stories behind America's best-loved patriotic songs.
This is certainly good timing. And I imagine that the timing of it is not lost on you or your publisher, that you are, in a sense, capitalizing on something at a very propitious moment in time. But I'm sure more than good timing motivates the writing of this book.
Well, it's interesting in the fact that I pitched this idea 10 years ago, and it was rejected along with the Christmas book and others. And so I wrote, in the process, a lot more books and came back to it. And actually... the book idea was hatched, and the contracts were signed, and the initial research done or started before 9/11. So the fact that the book is coming out at a time when all of this is going on in the world is something that we obviously hadn't planned on. And I just felt that when people hear songs like God Bless America or things like that, there is a certain feeling that happens that if they knew the story behind these songs, if they understood the way that they came to be known so well by Americans and used so well by Americans, because there have been thousands of patriotic songs written since 1776, and yet there's only a handful that we actually know and know well. And
I'm so glad you said that, because I review compact discs for the National Association of Teachers of Singing, for their Journal of Singing. And I recently reviewed a very interesting compact disc called Great Singers Sing Patriotic Songs. And these go way back to the turn of the century and are primarily operatically trained singers. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that was so striking, along with the fact that you have, for instance, recordings of the Star Spangled Banner a quarter of a century before it became our national anthem, I mean, right from the dawn of recorded sound, really, but was the fact that a number of these singers were recording patriotic songs that are now completely forgotten for one reason or another. Sometimes songs, I suppose, composed at a given moment in history where it made sense or spoke to people in a way that it maybe just doesn't anymore.
Well, and yet, I think that there is that. If you go back in history and you look particularly at World War II, there were a tremendous amount of songs written during World War II that had a great patriotic meaning during that time. I saw, not to be confused by much more with a much more modern song, Smoke on the Water was a huge hit in World War II. It was about a specific Marine unit, and it just swept the nation up. It topped the Billboard charts and everything else. It was a country music song, but you do not, and there were no country music charts at the time. It was topping the real charts. You don't hear those songs anymore. I think it takes a special song that has kind of timeless values to make it. There were songs in the Revolutionary War, that I wrote the stories behind that aren't in this book because HarperCollins had to cut it for length. One of them was called Liberty, which was a huge, vastly popular song the first 20 years of the nation that has now disappeared, and you just do not hear it at all. There are other songs that we hear that are from the Civil War, Revolutionary War and stuff. We don't know the words to them, but we recognize the music because the music has been used in Ken Burns documentaries on PBS or old movies about the Civil War and things like that. And so you have songs like Battle Cry of Freedom, which is a da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, it's a very, very well-known tune, but most people do not know it is actually from the Civil War. They don't know it was written in the height of the Civil War. They don't know the story of the person behind it, but they recognize it when they hear it. So even though the words are not familiar anymore, a few have hung on like that, thanks really to the motion picture industry.
So that's one that you chose to include in the book, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, yes. Yeah. You know, you look back at various times in our nation's history, and people may not realize this, but there were over 400 songs written about Lincoln himself during the Civil War and right after the Civil War. And so none of those survived. None of those are songs that we sing today. But so songs, you know, we think of today as being the song age because you put it out on records or videos and you get it out there. But songs have been an important part of American history forever, and hence the patriotic songs, because we have gone through traumas and wars and things like that are essential as well. And there were hundreds of them written during each conflict. There are just a few that survive. And those few are very, very special, and we've included them in this book. And once people, I think, know the stories behind them, they become more special.
We're speaking with Ace Collins, the author of Songs Sung, Red, White, and Blue, the stories behind America's best-loved patriotic songs. This is probably as good a point as any to mention that in choosing the 32 songs which are in the pages of this book, there are several that probably in the minds of some Americans are not standard patriotic songs. And in the preface of the book, you say that, you know, you've drawn from the left and the right, and along with the more sort of military-flavored patriotic songs, which we all know so well, you've also chosen a few that we might more aptly call kind of protest songs.
Well, Abraham, Martin, and John.
The very first one in the book, as a matter of fact.
Considered that. And you think about it, Abraham, Martin, and John was released at the same time, about the same time, you know, and from a general standpoint as Ballad of the Green Beret. And you have two songs that really evoke a very unique time, a time when I was a teenager in America in the 60s, and well, actually, 60s and 70s, I was a teenager in the 70s. You look at the trauma America was going through, and you look at people were looking for answers, since Abraham, Martin, and John really talks about Dion sang that song. It was actually written by Dick Feller, whose other big hit in life was Snoopy versus the Red Baron. So there's an irony there that this man who had written this great comic song about the comic strip dog would turn around and write this song that had such a catch-all for Americans during that time who were going through the shock and trauma of having assassinations and having riots in the streets and trying to figure out if America was ever going to be America again. And, you know, the mere fact that he ended that song, if you could listen to it, you can hear Martin Luther King's I Had a Dream speech in the background.
Hmm.
You start to get a feel that as much as this was a protest song, it was also a song that believed in America and believed in America very, very well. And, you know, the flip side of that, of course, was the song that Sergeant Barry Sadler wrote and sang. He was an ex-Green Beret. Actually, he was a Green Beret when he wrote the song about the troops that John F. Kennedy put together to Special Forces. And actually, Kennedy was inspired by the French Special Forces who wore the berets and stuff and fought in some very unique battles. And he put those together, and the Green Berets became this legendary group, but they were only a legendary group within the armed forces themselves. Very few people outside the forces knew about them. And Sergeant Barry Sadler came up with that. He sang that. It was put on Ed Sullivan and others, and it became the song that embraced the military at a time when the military service was not being embraced at all. And once again, it crossed lines. Abraham, Martin, and John was popular with conservatives and liberals both because it touched the heart. Even during the height of the Vietnam War, you had liberals also listening to Ballad of Green Berets because it talked about the sacrifices these men were involved with fighting in a war that they really didn't understand, a lot of them. And so I think you had those two songs really, probably as much as any other, defined a time in our country's history when we were having, it sounds funny, we're 200 years old, we were having growth pains, we were having insecurities, we were having moments when we weren't sure what the future held, and it was a scary time. And those two songs reflected that, I think, very, very well, and reflected the country's mood.
Yes. Well, and of course, it's interesting that some of the more stirring, basic patriotic songs, as we sort of think of them, often sprang up in the midst of moments of great uncertainty, and sprang up in spite of that uncertainty, and also sort of because of it, and directly in the face of it. That
I think, you know, and they also sprang up, you know, you look at a song like God Bless America, and God Bless America has been called Irving Berlin, probably the greatest American songwriter. It's his crowning achievement. Yet, what is really ironic about that was that Berlin wrote that during World War I, and he wrote it for a Broadway musical that he was putting on. And during the rehearsals of the musical, he was listening to God Bless America, which was the song that he had composed to finish the musical, to conclude the musical, the high point. And he listened to it and was so unaffected by it, he decided it was schmaltzy, uninspired, and completely irrelevant, and the American people would laugh at it. And so he took it out of the show and put it in a trunk and forgot about it. So here's this man who so reflects the American dream, because here, a Jewish immigrant, came over with his family as a child, worked in as a waiter, rose from Tin Pan Alley to become America's greatest songwriter. So he has lived the American dream. He looks at this song, God Bless America, and throws it away.
Hmm.
Well, there's another throwaway that's a part of this, too, and that's Kate Smith. Kate Smith was an incredible child prodigy, but when it came to making her life as a singer, making a living as a singer, people laughed at her because she was a very, very large woman. And she became, rather than the great singer on Broadway, she became the one that the comics brought out on stage and made fun of. They told all the fat jokes about her. So she was making a living, really, at her own expense, you know. And here is this dynamic woman who was probably never going to be anything but a joke, except radio came along. And it didn't make any difference what you looked like on radio. And so Kate Smith found a home. And in 1937, this woman who had been rejected for the first 10 years of her career, so embraced by radio, was looking for a song to sing on Veterans Day, which then was called Armistice Day. And she couldn't find one. And her agent and her manager called Irving Berlin. They talked to Berlin. Berlin remembered a song that he had thrown away 20 years before. They dug through his file cabinet until they found it. And here was a song that Berlin still thought was too hokey to really sing. It was performed for the first time in November of 1937, and people went absolutely crazy from the second they heard it on Kate Smith's show.
Hmm.
And so you have a rejected woman who was made fun of and an immigrant from Russia who came together to write what is probably the best love or write and bring to America, a song that had been rejected for 20 years and was the best loved America song ever, probably. I mean, you know, God Bless America is probably everyone's favorite. Well, not everyone's, but a majority of Americans' favorite song about America is God Bless America.
We're speaking with Ace Collins and about his book called Songs Sung, Red, White, and Blue, The Stories Behind America's Best-Loved Patriotic Songs. We should certainly spend at least a little bit of time talking about our national anthem, the Star-Spangled Banner. You really give us some fascinating information here about the genesis of the Star-Spangled Banner and Francis Scott Key, of course, a very familiar name to many. One of the things that's, of course, very interesting about this and others is when a patriotic song, or in this case our national anthem, begins its life as simply a poem with no music attached to it whatsoever.
The Defense of Fort McHenry was its name, yeah. The thing I find most interesting about it, the Star-Spangled Banner, is it took a calamity of mistakes and unusual decisions to create the song. We had a man who was a doctor in Marlboro, Maryland, named Beans, who had been entrusted with all of the important state papers of Maryland during the War of 1812. He locks them in a jail for safekeeping, and then, forgetting they're there, arrests two British soldiers for being drunk and disorderly and throws them in a jail with the most important papers in the state of Maryland. And so they didn't want to lose the papers. They didn't want to have them burned. And so when the British come in to free their soldiers, they're looking at the papers. And instead of noticing the papers, they get mad at Dr. Beans and arrest him. Well, Francis Scott Key was called upon by the people of Marlborough. He was a very famous attorney who knew British law, to go and ask for the release of Dr. Beans. He went to the ship, the prisoner ship that Dr. Beans was being held on. He talked to the British admiral in Baltimore Harbor. The British admiral listened to him and said, no, I'm not going to release this man. He is an enemy of the state. And then, in a Perry Mason-style move, Key pulls out of his pocket letters written by British soldiers to Dr. Beans, thanking him for saving their lives. So this doctor, who was very, very pro-American, nevertheless would save the life of anyone in need, and so many, many wounded soldiers were saved. And so the admiral said, okay, we'll let him go, but we're not going to let any of you go until after we fight and take this fort, because you know too much about our defenses.
Hmm.
So what happens is they get stuck on the prisoner ship the next 3 days waiting for the battle. Well, the battle itself is a battle that is fraught with British mistakes and also some American ingenuity that allows Francis Scott Key to be inspired. The general at the fort decided he wanted the British to know that he was in charge of that area. And the best way he knew to do it was to have a flag maker make the biggest American flag that had ever been made. This thing was like 30 feet wide. And so he is sitting there with a 100-foot flagpole at this fort with a flag that's 30 feet wide. And so you can see it from miles and miles away. And it just so happened that Francis Scott Key was 8 miles away. We think of him now as being, 150 yards from the fort when he sees the flag the next morning through the smoke and the mist. But no, the only way he saw the flag was because this commander decided he was going to have the biggest flag in the world. So here he is, 8 miles away. He pulls up a spyglass. He watches this incredible battle with rockets and all these other things. And rockets, by the way, were kind of a new thing, and they didn't work at all. The reason you hear the rockets bursting in midair is because they never made it to the fort. They had them set all wrong. They were too far away, and so the rockets were breaking up long before they got to their objective. And the British just had a series of miscalculations on what they were doing, and the next day the gunfire was quiet, and Key thought, well, we've lost the battle. He borrows a spyglass from a British man, looks at it, and there is the flag still flying. And that's what inspired him to write the poem Star Spangled Banner. By the way, like many of our great American songs, the music that it was matched to, and this is really, I think, very ironic, was, of course, an old British song. So it was an old British pub song. They used this to celebrate as they went and had their ale in British pubs. And so this song that had more than 100 different lyrics attached to it finally found a home where the lyrics and the words went together in a song that was originally called The Defense of Fort McHenry, which we now know as the Star-Spangled Banner.
I've always wanted to hear that melody more in its original form as a pub song with some of the lyrics that might have been attached to it.
And ironically enough, Key, 2 years before, who was a poet, had actually written the song and then written a song that was a salute to Stephen Decatur, the great American admiral, and had set that song to the same music. So it wasn't the first time he'd used the music either.
So we don't know if he had this tune specifically in mind for these words, but he maybe did have that tune, maybe at least in his subconscious as he wrote these words.
And, of course, he wrote it on the back of an envelope, and I've always wondered if the envelope that he wrote that song on the back of and went to, later and polished it at a hotel where he was staying, but if the envelope wasn't one of the envelopes that one of the British soldiers had sent to praise Dr. Beans. So it took a lot of different things coming together to make, our national anthem a song that we embrace and love. And like so many, it was probably never meant to be heard and never meant to be used. As a matter of fact, it got out and people got to know about it simply because Key's brother-in-law was so impressed that he had it printed up and distributed to people on the streets and throughout Baltimore. And the first place it was ever sung with this tune, by the way, was once again in a tavern. So, and we didn't. Another thing people think, well, gosh, ever since there's been baseball, we've had national anthems and football games. No, that didn't happen to World War II.
That's right. You mentioned that fact, and you said that some people believed fervently, and maybe there are a few that still do, that in order not to trivialize the national anthem, it should only be used for government events. But
very special events. They were afraid if you heard it at every baseball game, it would just become another song, and people wouldn't respond to it in a positive way, and it would just be, okay, let's get it over with so we can get the game going on. Yeah.
You also mentioned that this became our national anthem in 1931, mm-hmm. and that at the time that that choice was made, there was some controversy, that there were a fair number of Americans who believed that a better choice would have been America the Beautiful.
America the Beautiful and another group that believed My Country 'Tis of Thee. Mm-hmm. And there was quite a controversy over it. And actually, Catherine Bates, who wrote America the Beautiful, weighed in for Star Spangled Banner.
Interesting.
So she was one of the forces who wrote her congressman and said, no, it needs to be the Star Spangled Banner, which had been kind of the unofficial national anthem since at least the Civil War, because it had been played by military bands at specific military events and things like that. But America had no national anthem for the first 170 years or 160 years of its existence.
I do want to ask you about America the Beautiful, which happens to be my favorite and, more significantly, the favorite of many, many Americans. One thing that I didn't realize is that there are original lyrics slightly different from those which are much more familiar. Can you tell us why there are essentially two sets of lyrics for America the Beautiful?
Well, not only do you have two sets of lyrics, the song was set to over 100 different melodies at one time or another, too, until it actually latched on to, a melody that stuck, essentially speaking, the song. And most people know this. Catherine Bates was a professor at Wellesley. She was, what they don't realize, that she was in Colorado on Pikes Peak because she'd taken a summer job teaching, because she wanted to see the American West. She was quite an adventurer. I mean, she was a preacher's kid. She just went everywhere and did everything that she could possibly do. A woman well ahead of her time in so many different ways. And when she was in Colorado Springs teaching, she went up on Pikes Peak, and she was so impressed by what she saw on this train ride and then later a wagon ride up to the top of the peak that she sat down, pulled out her journal, and copied down a poem. Now, she did that a lot. She was not really, planning on sharing that with anyone, but she did it a great deal. And when she wrote this poem up here on 14,000 feet, she took it back. She was in no rush to share it with anyone or anything else. And after she'd gotten back to Wellesley, she read it again, really for the first time. And when she read it, she was deeply disappointed because she felt it hadn't captured the majesty that she had actually witnessed there. And so she did some polishing, she did some rewriting, and ultimately speaking, she sent it off to another, a publisher who published it in a book. Long story short, we could go on forever on the story because it's a wonderful story, and people who want to really read about this song and love this song like you do should read Lynn Scher's book that is a huge book all about America the Beautiful. Lynn Scher the Great, who was with ABC News forever, if you remember her.
Yes.
Well.
Oh, yes.
And the book is just wonderful. But this woman wrote this thing. She refined the lyrics. She put it out. And ironically enough, it was published by the same magazine that published the Battle Hymn of the Republic initially. And so you have this poem being published. Then you have a race for the next 4 years with everybody in the country trying to write music for it because everybody knew it was inspired. And they couldn't find music for it that fit. And Catherine Bates would play it before with 20 or 30 different people. She didn't want to insult anyone. Whoever wrote the music, that was fine with her. Eventually, they found music that had been written for a hymn, and they pulled it away from the hymn. And the man who had written the hymn was an American success story in himself, and he had passed away the year before it was matched to his song.
Oh, yes, Samuel Ward.
And Samuel Ward's song became the foundation that holds America the Beautiful together. And you combine the two, and you can't imagine. I know this happens a lot because it happened time and time again in Christmas music when I researched that, but you have the coming together of two different people who never met, who lived in different time frames, a lot of cases, but it took both of their inspiration to pull together a song that has become timeless. I remember Hark the Herald Angels Sing was written by Wesley in England, and then the music was written by Mendelssohn, and both of them didn't like to have their work played with it all, and so after they both died, and Mendelssohn had written the original music for that as a salute to Gutenberg for the printing press, and on the anniversary of printing of the press coming together, and they brought them together, and it became Hark There, Old Angels Sing. We can't imagine it any other way. Yet these two gentlemen were so stubborn that in their lifetime they would not allow any other music or any other words to be applied to their own creation. So it took both of them in some ways passing on for the magic to happen. And these people were both inspired, and yet it came together.
Hmm.
You know, my favorite story in the whole book is the George M. Cohen story that you can tell real quickly.
For Yankee Doodle Dandy. Grand Ole Flag.
You know, he's got Over There, he's got all these great things. But Cohen was a legend in 1905 with Little Johnny Jones, which had Give My Regard to Broadway and I'm a Yankee Doodle Dandy in it. And he had bought a car, and he was cruising down from his country home into New York, and he was going to find, you know, he was just on top of the walk. And if you have seen, even though it's largely fictionalized, if you've seen the movie about George M. Cohen where Jimmy Stewart plays him, Yankee Doodle Dandy, you get an idea that Cohen was a man who was very confident. He was cocky. I mean, he was a man who believed in Cohen. And he spent most of his time talking and very little time listening, I found out in doing his research, too. But as he was driving along the road that day, he saw an old man waiting for a ride. And this man, well, not actually waiting for a ride, he saw him walking along the road. This man was probably old enough and poor enough he'd never even ridden in a car. Cohen asked him if he wanted a ride. This man got in the car, in these tattered clothes, this white beard, and started talking to Cohen as they rode along. As he talked, he kept petting this piece of cloth, this old rag that he held in his arms. And Cohen was amazed by the man's stories, because he told him about the Civil War. This man had been a Union trooper in the Civil War, and he had fought throughout the entire Civil War. And he told him with a great deal of pride, "I was the flag bearer, and the entire time I was the flag bearer, that flag never dropped and it never dipped. Even during the time when Pickett charged us, I never lost that flag." And Cohen listened to this man speak of this flag with such great pride. And then he realized that the object in this man's arms that he was petting like a little kitten was the very flag that he had carried throughout the entire Civil War. And the man's last words before he got out of the car was, "Mr. Cohen," and he patted that flag one more time, "It's a grand old rag, sir. It's a grand old rag."
When I love the phrase right before it, you quote, "It was all for this."
All for this.
It was all for this.
And, of course, Cohen went back and he wrote the song. And he wrote it as Grand Ole Rag, as the story had been told to him, but the public did not respond well to that. He changed it to Grand Ole Flag. And so if you think about it, and I think this is what makes a lasting impression on all of us, if you think about it, that man who never let that flag drop, that man who made the statement, "It was all for this," because of George M. Cohen, that flag that he carried is still flying. And I think that is an incredible thought, to realize that this trooper who died soon after he told the story, this obscure man whose name we don't even know, is still proudly carrying that flag.
Yeah, his courage lives on.
Every time we hear that song, that flag he's carrying still high and mighty, and it's still not dipping.
Hmm. Well, especially once we know the song, thanks to your marvelous book called Songs Sung, Red, White, and Blue, the stories behind America's best-loved patriotic songs, 32 of them in all, published by Harper Resource, an imprint of HarperCollins, and the author, Ace Collins.
Before I let you go, I got to tell your people one more thing. There's another book we have out, ironically enough, at the same time. It is published by Zondervan, called Hymns That Have Inspired America, and the stories behind them. And if they like this book, they'll probably also like that, because a lot of the songs, the hymns that have meant so much, carried us through the wars and the traumatic times with assassination and others, they might find it very, very interesting.
What is that title again?
Hymns That Inspire America. And it's another book that's kind of in the same vein as this book.
Very good. Ace Collins, a real pleasure to read this book and to talk with you about it on The Morning Show. Thank you so much for your time.
What a delight to be with you, and thank you for your time.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, which will launch an RN to BSN program this January. Practicing nurses with an associate degree can complete a Bachelor of Science in Nursing in 16 months, taking a mix of online and on-campus courses. For more information,